Mr. Henderson, Reel 18. Can you tell me, Mr. Henderson, your memories of that journey, fighting journey, up the road towards Arnhem?
Yes, the roads were packed. We weren't in the lead at this particular time. We went over Grave Bridge. And I think this is where I had one of my most frightening moments of the whole war. For no reason at all. It was just a matter of... And the Americans had taken Grave Bridge, the American airborne. And the gliders had come down. And we were parked, it was a terribly wet night. And we parked up along this canal embankment thing. And we slept in the underneath the gliders. And up came Pinocchio. I'm on guard, as is usual. Dark, wet, terrible, stormy night. And I'm on top of the embankment, on top of the dike, when up along came the post truck. RHQ staff was somewhere down in one of the gliders, and he said to me, "Where's RHQ?" I said, "I'll show you." And I jumped on the side of his vehicle and drove down to where RHQ were, and walked back to where my post was. And on walking back between the gliders, I lost my sense of direction because the field was full of gliders. And I fell over. And when I put my hand out to find out what I'd fallen over, it was a dead American, paratrooper. And I just froze, and it was because it was dark at night, and I was wet, and I was on my own, and the hairs went up on, and I could have just fainted, I could have screamed. I was so frightened. I don't know what I was frightened of. There was nothing to hurt me. And anyway, I stood up and I was just a bag of nerves. And I shouted and somebody shouted and we walked towards each other. And it was the relief that had come to relieve me for the thing. But that was a thing, a silly little thing. But...
Mr. Shorey, what state you were in at this time?
Yes. The following morning... were issued with the tank chutes. That's where we got our tank chute. In that field was where they came with the tank chutes and gave us all these beautiful tank chutes. That was Grave. The next one was Eindhoven. When we got to Eindhoven, Phillips have a factory at Eindhoven. The roads are crowded with people. As we came off where the gliders were, Montgomery was there. And he came, I have my hat on the back of my head, I'm standing waiting for the traffic to get past, I have a cigarette in the corner of my mouth, Montgomery came along in his staff car, and I couldn't get my hat on straight and my fag out of my mouth, I was expecting to get 28 days jankers for this, but anyway he took no notice and went past, and then that night we parked that night on Phillips Television Works car park, and we slept under the tanks on the car park at Phillips factory in Eindhoven. And then the following day we were heading up towards the Nijmegen Bridge, and as we crossed over the Nijmegen Bridge, which is just like Newcastle Tyne Bridge, the same kind of structure, they'd bombed it. They'd already tried to knock it out the night before, but like Newcastle, there's a bridge further up, which is a railway bridge, and they brought that down. They'd sent some swimmers down through the night, some frogmen, and they'd knocked that's how they knocked that bridge out. But when we got over the bridge, they put a hole in the bridge while I was on it, and I was about, there was a jeep, then there was a tank, another tank. The jeep turned over. When I got to them, which was only about a minute after, they were all the colour of a banana. They'd all turned yellow with the blast. And then we came to the end of the bridge and had to turn left along the side of the canal. And all along the side of that canal were dead Germans with their throats cut. And the Americans were walking back with a little paper stars and stripes on the shoulder. They were heading back. They'd done their job and they were heading back I don't know where they were going.
The American paratroops?
Yes. One of them said something about where have you been or something. And we said, we came over on D-Day, not Tuesday. That was one of the things we said. But I was saying that the roads were crowded with vehicles. They told us that if anything broke down, it wasn't allowed to stop. It was all one way. It was all one way. And that it was pushed off the road. There was no going back. Everything was one way. There was no... That was up. There would be other roads that were going back, but this was the club route up. Signed by a club. Everything was on the way up. Oh, great. No, if there'd been any German planes about, well, it would have been another Falaise Gap. But I was saying earlier, they said that if it was a silver plane, it was an American. If it was a painted plane, camouflaged, it was English, British. And if you couldn't see them, they were German. And that's how it was. There was no German planes at all until the 1st of January, which is another story.
But you were making your way up this road. And
yes.
Were you stopped? Was there fighting on the way up?
Heavy fighting then. There was villages, if I remember rightly. Now, by this time, I think the paratroops, our 6th Airborne, was in Arnhem, fighting for their lives, and we were trying to get to them. There was a village called Elst, which put up stiff, very, very stiff resistance. There was another village called Oosterhout. These are the villages between Nijmegen and Arnhem. These are the two names I can remember, and I can't remember many names. But those two stick out. As we were in the same village as Elst, as the Germans, at the same time, fighting for the village. We went out; they went out of one end, and we were still in. We were chasing them out the other end. That's how near we were to them. And it was the same at Oosterhout. We lost a lot of infantry, a lot of casualties between those two bridges. They were holding us. They didn't want us to get to that Arnhem Bridge. And by the time we got there, of course, the bridge was down. We couldn't get over the bridge to give support to the... It was dreadful. It was a dreadful time. And
Elst,
the weather was terrible.
When you were in Elst, was that house-to-house fighting?
Yes. Yes.
How does a... What's the role of a tank in that situation? What kind of thing were you doing?
If you think somewhere there, you knock the house down. There's nothing else you can do. And the Dutch people were absolutely fantastic. They're a different breed completely from the Belgians and the French. They had a different sense of, I don't know, they were so patriotic, the Dutch people. I know there was quite a lot of young boys left Holland into the German army. Quite understandable. The thrill and all this of, they were the big thing, they were going to rule the world, and they had plenty of food, marvellous uniform. Our boys would have been the same, sure. We were, when we joined the army, we wanted to be in at 16. We wanted to be in it. And the Dutch people at that time were absolutely starving. They had nothing to eat at all. That's another little story I could tell you. But a lot of very bitter fighting. And you didn't shell a house for the sake of shelling it. I remember one occasion opening up. But this is later on, when the Dutch people were going to church in all the best black, when all our machine guns opened up at Plains, New Year's morning, 45, and they all dropped down in the best black into the snow. The Dutch people were fantastic, but we had to do quite a lot of damage there. And of course, it's very wet grass, wet fields up round about there, dikey wet land. You couldn't run off the roads, so we were sort of trapped onto the roads.
And you'd make good targets, no doubt.
Yes, yes, you couldn't escape. But to say there was no planes. We had these Panzerfaust things, and the small 50mm anti-tank guns. They were the danger things.
Were they good weapons, the Panzerfaust particularly?
They were. They would knock tracks off tanks and put you out of action. They'd stop you. They didn't put you out of action, but they'd stop you. You could still shoot. But, of course, if you were stopped on a road like that, they could easily block the roads by tanks, so nothing could come up. Things like that, you know, and then those tanks had to be got out of the way before the tanks could come up. These are things that happened, especially in the snow later on in the Ardennes.
What was the result then of this particular action period, from your point of view?
The result was that we finally got up to the river, too late.
And you got there?
Yes,
the
too late. The bridge was down, and nothing could be done about it. We eventually pulled back into Nijmegen. The remainder of the paratroops got over the river in small boats and things.
What was your feelings that you hadn't reached them?
Broken hearted. They were our boys over there. And bitterness against the command for putting them in too early. If they'd been delayed, which was quite easy. And then, of course, after our lads had got the hammer, we sent the Poles in as well. They also got the hammer. A lot of mistakes made at Arnhem. From what I've heard, from boys that have told us that they had the wrong radios, they couldn't contact the planes, they couldn't contact... No, well, neither could we. But they were dropping rations and ammunition out of reach of them, and there were... The Germans were getting their ammunition and things. They were very short of ammunition. Quite a lot of mistakes made.
Were you blaming Montgomery?
Oh, no. I mean, it wasn't his idea to drop them when they did. It would be the high command that decided the time. Strategic command. No, Montgomery was all right. There was nothing wrong in Montgomery. He wouldn't throw lives away. Never.
You mentioned briefly there that the Dutch people had no food, and you had a story about it. What was that?
Well, there was a case. It was a case later on, after we'd been down to the Ardennes, and after we came back from up to Nijmegen, and we were preparing for the push over the Rhine, push into Germany, February. A big attack, they reckon it was the biggest barrage since Alamein. And then we moved up early in the morning to advance into Germany.
We'll come about, you know, we'll
but
come
while
to
we're waiting, while we're waiting for this, while we're waiting for this big advance, we were at the start line. This was the day before. And a couple of girls walked up to us, and we walked back with them into the village. And, they took us to where they were sleeping, and they were all sleeping in a parish hall. And when you went in the parish hall to the right hand corner, that's where their little part was, that was their house. And different families had different little places. They were sleeping on the floor, bits of straw. The old man had no boots on, and they would give us something to eat, and it was terrible. It was dreadful. We didn't want to take it, but they made us have this little piece of. And I said to the lad I was with, I said, this is dreadful. And I said to the girl, well, what is it like? What? And she said it was what I thought was kipping or something. And I said, I'm sure that's mouse. And I said, little mouse. And she said, yes. And when we went outside into the yard, she showed us the tails and that she'd cut off and the little heads. And I felt like being sick. So we never ate anywhere. We went back up to the tank. We had plenty of food, plenty of tins of M&V, meat and veg, tins of butter, and a bottle of wine I had. So I put the bottle of wine in my tunic and a few tins, and a pair of old boots that I reckoned would fit the old fella. And he did the same. Oh, it was a Welsh lad. It was a Welsh lad, Davis. Taffy Davis it was. And we both walked back to the thing, and we went in with the food and we put it down into the girl that would try to explain what it was. And the lady was a fat lady, and she put her arms round my neck and she just about broke me back and kissing me and trying, and the old man put his boots on. I had them tied and put round my neck, an old pair of boots. And they were all in tears that we brought this food down for them. And then we walked back up to the thing, and then we went back next day. But after the Arnhem touch, which was September, back end of September, we waited until We waited in September, October, in Nijmegen. We were stuck then. We couldn't go any farther. And I think we were all held up in Nijmegen.
What was happening to you in Nijmegen? Did you get the chance for dances and social activities?
Yes. Now, that is October. This is the time of the... We weren't in Nijmegen. We were in a little village called Winsen. W-I-N-S-O-N. Winsen. Between Nijmegen and Grave, I think it was. Or between Nijmegen and Eindhoven. A little village called Winsen. And I was in a dreadful state. I had this thing on my face. And this is when I got put a week into hospital to get it cleared up. A couple of weeks, 10 days or so, whatever, into hospital. And when I came back, well, that was before. Anyway, I couldn't go to the dance, the balaclava dance, because I had no hair on. My hair was just short. I looked like a gollywog, and my face was all covered in scabs, and I wouldn't go. But they brought the regiment. The whole regiment was put off standby, were free of duties to attend the balaclava ball, which was held in Nijmegen. And apparently it was a marvellous night, and all the Dutch girls came, and of course the balaclava charge is when all the boys line up at one side of the room and all the girls stand at the other, and they all charge, and that was the balaclava charge. It's a marvellous day, that, in the regiment. It's tradition.
Where were you billeted?
I was in a cellar in Vincent, a little cellar, three of us, a concrete floor, and I'd managed to get some straw and put a piece of tarpaulin over the straw to try and make a bit of a bed, because concrete floors are pretty hard. We never had any sheets. We just had the three blankets in the winter and the four in the summer. And you used your greatcoat as a pillar. That's where we were sleeping. Quite safe and warm in there. Warmish for October.
Did the Dutch invite you into their homes for meals?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, that's another little story that's in the Ardennes, where they invited us in. The officers were looking for somewhere for us to sleep, and she said, well, we have no spare bedrooms or whatever. They had two boys and then a house, something like this, a semi-detached house. I think it was semi-detached. And he was an official on the railway, big man, and the officer said, oh yes, they don't want beds, they're going to sleep on the floor. You'll get seven in here. So seven of us slept in this front room, the sitting room, round the floor. We had loaded pistols, which shouldn't have been loaded, and we took our boots off in early hours of the morning, and tanks were parked outside in the street, and it was snowing like hell, and ice and snow, terrible weather. The tanks were sliding all over the roads with this ice, and he sent one of his sons in to collect our boots. And he cleaned them. They didn't know what to do for us, so they cleaned our boots, which were wet, you know, wet army boots, and brought them back and took another pair, and he cleaned those. And the little boy of about 10 or 11, saw the pistol, and as boys are, he took the pistol out of its holster, which is lying on the floor, and pulled the trigger, and it went off, and the bullet stuck in the side of the fireplace. In the, you know, the piece at the side of the upright of the fireplace, it stuck in there. And he dropped the gun and ran, and the old man came through, and we all woke up. Very fortunate that no one had been killed. And the father said, I'm never going to hide that. I'm going to keep it there as a souvenir of the war. And she wanted us to have our... She did make us have our meals there. We had a cookhouse at this particular time across the road, and we couldn't sit down to have it. We'd get the food in a little dixie, and the rain coming down, and our overcoats on, and was standing in the yard eating it, and the rain was filling the Dixie and, as you were eating it. You know, it was a bit rough, the food wise, but never mind, we didn't have it to cook. But she would have us, we'd given her a lot of tinned stuff. We filled our things with a lot of, we were sick of meat and veg. Meat and veg. It was very, very good food. The Americans went mad for it, and they'd give us some of theirs, which we didn't like. It was all right for a couple of days, and then it was too much seasoning. But anyway, she would make us have our dinner there, and she cooked us a dinner with using this meat and veg and potatoes. It wasn't like the same food that we cooked. She'd made a marvellous job of cooking, because it was good food. And a lot of pickled cabbage. They ate a lot of... They used pickled cabbage... Not as a pickled cabbage, as cabbage, and a lot of potatoes. The big eaters of potatoes, but they were a lovely couple. They'll be dead now, but the Tretters like royalty.
And this was the same in Nijmegen when you were there.
Yes. We stayed in a butcher's shop, above a butcher's shop, and the girl that worked there was the chief of police's daughter. I think she only worked there so she'd get some extra food, but. Vanderwald or something her name was, but she was a little fat lass, and I remember I was on guard once at Nijmegen, and she came and stood with us all the time I was on guard, and that was she worked in the butcher shop. Lovely people. And if you go back today, they happened to stop with 50 div in the back window, on the front window, and the lady got on and she said, "We will never forget. Thank you very much." And it upset the boys on the bus. They were nearly in tears at the gratitude of this old woman.
Were there any liaisons started between troops and young girls?
Well, I had a liaison with this little Hetty Vanderhaal. She was all right. She was a nice little lass. There was nothing out of place happened. But we didn't do with anything out of place, not in the 1318 Hussars. At least if I did, we couldn't put it on this tape. But we didn't. We were at least, I think everywhere, times have changed. You'd go out with a girl for a month before you would kiss her goodnight in those days. Not now. But anyway, there were happy days. And then suddenly, we were called to go to the Ardennes. And this was on November the 9th, 44. But until then, we'd been servicing our vehicles in Nijmegen. There was an air raid in Nijmegen. We were at a theatre. There was a theatre group came to Nijmegen. This was like a long rest. We were asking about a rest. Oh, this about, I think, the first one we ever had, where you were in a town, and it was a... There was a YMCA, and in the garden of the YMCA was a grave of two Canadian soldiers. In the grounds of the YMCA, I remember. And if I remember, you went down the main street of Nijmegen, and there was a fork, and the YMCA was in the front of the fork. This was before the bridge, and in the point of the fork was two Canadian graves. They'll not be there now. They've been taken away to a proper cemetery. But this is just a vague memory. And to the left of this fort was a theatre, and there was some well-known personality was on at this theatre, live theatre that night, and I can't think who it was. And I might think later on, but there was either a shelling, probably shelling, and no one took any notice, the concert party didn't stop. It just went on. But at this particular time, we were sleeping inside. We weren't sleeping out in the roads.
Was Nijmegen badly damaged by shell?
Pretty badly damaged, yes. It was quite a city. Quite a big city. With shelling.
So you were called, as you say, on November the 9th to the Ardennes. What was the reason for that?
Well, although we didn't realise it at the time, that the Germans were going to do a counterattack. But I think Montgomery who was at this particular time in charge of all operations, because Eisenhower was in Brussels, having a liaison with some higher authority or whatever. But Montgomery was in charge of everything, and he sent us down at night. We had to cover our div signs up, and he left it until evening time to move down to Nijmegen, down to a place called Brunsum, which was just on the Dutch side of the German border. And then we moved from there. That was early hours of the morning when we got there. It was the longest, terrible long night driving down in the dark. And
you still have these really... You couldn't use lights.
One little tail light was all that I had. One little tail light to follow. One tiny little tail light. And as you got tired, it kept coming and going. And then pulled in the early hours of the morning and just went straight to sleep. And the lads woke me up with a cup of tea at 10 o'clock in the morning, a pint pot of tea. And then we moved over the border, and our job there was to go into to hold the line over the winter. We went in for a week and come out for a fortnight. And the other brigade regiments would take over from us. And to hold the line, the Guards Armoured Division also came down, and the 53rd Welsh Division also came down, and the 8th Armoured Brigade. That's who it was. To hold the line over the winter.
What was the terrain like that you were holding and the Germans were holding?
What was it like? Well, it wasn't like it wasn't like Arnhem. It wasn't like it. That wasn't flat as that, and it wasn't bushy like the Bocage country. It was, well, it was Germany. It was the place we're holding was Geilenkirchen. Geilenkirchen was a city, and they were in the city, I think. Because I seem to remember that we used to put tin cans across the street, and if anything happened and you were in the cellars. And I remember the RSM running into the cellar with his driver, and I was behind them, and when I ran into the cellar, the RSM swore he'd been hit, and he was bending over with his trousers down, and his driver was looking at his bottom, and he said, "You haven't been hit." It caught his trousers on a bit of sharp metal, but he thought he'd been hit by shrapnel. And I just burst out laughing. I couldn't help it. But we're holding this line, and then we did later on we were moving up into the surrounding villages, and C Squadron lost quite a few tanks there in counterattacks there. But the Americans lost an awful lot. They came through on our right, and we held our sector, but they come into the American sector and really clobbered them. They had the Americans really running, and it was touch and go whether we were getting to get back to Brussels.
And this was the December...
Battle of the Bulge. This is the Battle of the Bulge.
But, so you were holding this position for quite a while. We'd obviously have infantry with you.
Yes. I remember we'd been in a week, and we came out, and the infantry were wet, and as we came back into Brunsum, we were on the middle of the road, and the infantry were down the side. I think it was the Middlesex, and the Americans were standing on the pavement asking for souvenirs. And I was never so proud to be British in all my life.